It's natural water. The stuff we get's been recycled 1,000 times, and it's dosed with suppressants. Doesn't it bother you that you spend your life in a state of drug-induced tranquility?
Why should the administration try to drug us?
To keep control. They've been stepping up the suppressants because the number of dissidents is growing. They've seen what's happening and they want to stop it.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Iranians and the Russians blame the US for 9/11. Now the Saudis are saying so too. Everyone except the Washington and London media. Yes, last weekend, Saudi Arabia splashed an incredible headline across several of its national newspapers. The US itself blew up the World Trade Center on 9/11 as an excuse to begin a never-ending war on terror, giving it an excuse to invade every country on Earth. But the big story is, why hasn't the London media reported? That is what Riyadh is saying. And some of us have been saying that, including the former German technology minister, Andreas von Bülow, since 2001. Staying with the censorship, and why so little coverage of the British win at the Cannes Film Festival, the Palme d'Or for Ken Loach? Could it have anything to do with the fact that the film I, Daniel Blake, criticises the Tory austerity programme? And while many believe capitalism died in 2008, when did it begin? We go back to look at the conflict between early capitalism's biggest fan, Adam Smith, and others like Thomas More and Karl Marx, who pointed out big omissions in the story the nation was being sold during the early years of the Industrial Revolution. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Our sister show Dialects, back at noon every Tuesday. Next week, the Pitchford inquiry into police spies, infiltrating groups and even having children with activists who hadn't even broken the law. Shane Collins is one of the main participants in the inquiry and he's a Green Party Mendip councillor too. Also, we talked to former Marine Corps veteran and combat reformer Mike Sparks. He explains how he thinks the US military needs to change to regain respect in the world. All at noon next Tuesday. But first, Martin, news today that American Special Forces have becoming more involved in the Syria combat. US Special Forces on the ground, as you mentioned briefly with Mark just now. This is a little bit worrying, isn't it? Apparently, the Green Berets have been in Syria, but they're wearing Kurdish militia insignia on their uniforms.
Well, there's been a lot of interference by outside forces in the whole conflict from the get-go.
Should we be surprised by the fact that Special Forces are in there?
No. We shouldn't be surprised, but we should also recognise that we are involved in the war in Syria.
Well, we had a question, didn't we, at Prime Minister's Questions from Angus Robertson a couple of months ago, who, by the way, it looks as if he's been hit by some kind of sting operation, a honey trap woman, in the meantime. But he's basically saying that we need some kind of parliamentary oversight of special forces, that is to say the SAS, people like that, because there isn't any.
Well, the fact of the matter is that we have basically encouraged armed groups inside Syria to try and overthrow the government of the country. Now, whatever you think of the government of the country, that's a pretty extreme strategy, and of course it hasn't worked.
So is Britain
so
at
we've
war?
Created we've created a bloodbath.
Is Britain at war? Martin, is Britain at war with Syria?
Effectively, yes. And of course,
that's not been through Parliament.
Well, don't remember we had a vote that we were going
bombing
to
it, Martin. That was about bombing it from the
bombing,
air.
Bombing it for the air. Yeah, but I mean, British special forces in particular have been working both in Libya and in Syria on the ground with Islamic extremist groups, just as they did in the 1980s in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And there is, in fact, overwhelming evidence for anybody who has got any kind of historical sense at all, particularly the Takfiri Salafi groups, which have been wrecking Syria and wrecked Afghanistan in the 1980s, they have intimate relations with British special forces. And the idea that we are not somehow responsible for this chaos is simply wrong. Somebody should be held responsible. What I say to individual British service people who are involved in this kind of shenanigan is you may have been promised by the government that you will be protected, but in actual fact you are engaged in illegal activity, and ultimately you may have to pay the price for that. And of course the people who sent you should also pay the price. It is illegal under international law to sponsor terrorism in other people's countries, which is what we've been doing. Now, ultimately, we've killed a lot of people and a lot of chaos has been created. But ultimately, those responsible inside the British security structure should be held responsible. And by that, I mean prison sentences.
I mean, why should we look, but why sentences. Should we be in the least bit responsible or concerned even that the US has actually sent special forces into Syria to deal with ISIS? That's exactly what
they're not dealing with ISIS. That's nobody believes that on the ground in Syria and across the Middle East. British special forces have been in there training and arming jihadi groups to fight the Syrian army.
They're assisting the Syrian Democratic Forces, which I've not heard of before, are very very closely in targeting ISIS positions.
No, they're not.
With mortars and laser-guided airstrikes.
There is an absolute fog of war around all of this. I'm quite sure that the Syrian General Staff, the Iranian General Staff, and the Russian General Staff have made their position clear. They actually see... I mean, the Iraqi military have been issuing statements, which are not reported in our media, saying that they've seen British and American planes dropping weapons to ISIS. And we know that the British Special Forces have been inside Syria working with groups which are jihadi groups. Not necessarily directly ISIS, but then they desert to ISIS.
Now, what about these photographs that have surfaced this week of some of the American soldiers wearing bright red, yellow and green patches of the Kurdish People's Protection Units that have proved some of the most committed and effective fighters on the ground against ISIS?
Well, the politics of this war are becoming very complex. The Kurdish Protection Units, of course, are aligned with the PKK in Turkey, which is, of course, regarded by the Americans as a terrorist organisation and by the British. Nevertheless,
by the Turks,
of course. Nevertheless, when in Syria, they're cooperating with this terrorist group in order to fight
ISIS. We're hearing lots and lots of blurred lines. What are the real fault lines, the real battle lines in Syria?
The real battle line in Syria is between the secular regime, which has got a wide backing from the minority communities, the Christians, the Alawites, etc. And also, of course, the Sunni, the Syrian army is dominated by Sunnis, so they have been, they've not been excluded. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, of Damascus, who's the main, the most senior Muslim in Syria, has had his son assassinated by terrorists supplied with weaponry by us. And, of course, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, pointed out on French television a couple of years ago that when he was a foreign minister, he was approached by British officials, by which he meant MI6, who said, "We are going to run an armed uprising in Syria." So I'm afraid the evidence points to the fact that NATO, led by Britain and the US with their Turkish allies, have created the war in Syria. They just can't win it because they haven't got enough popular support on the ground. And the Syrian regime, in fact, has majority support in Syria, which is why our attempts to overthrow them have been so misguided. And, of course, ultimately they will win. And I believe that the people in the West who have actually started the war should be put on trial and sent to prison, and life should mean life.
Bomb attacks last weekend, severe... I hesitate to use the word suicide bombing because if it's a car bomb, for example, it's very difficult to know whether the person driving the car actually knew that. These bombs can sometimes be operated remotely. You don't know whether someone's a suicide bomber or not 99% of the time. So, but they're very happy to use that term because it kind of demonises the opposition. You know, there must be some kind of kamikaze madman. And these have been against effectively against the centres of Russian power in Syria.
Well, no, they've been civilian targets.
Yes, but they're in the I think it's an airfield and a port which are used by the Russians.
Yes, but no Russian military personnel were killed in any of those attacks.
No, but they're in those places where the Russians are.
So in other words, what they're trying to do is by killing civilians about half a mile down the road from the Russian military base, which is a hard target. You're going to find that difficult to hit. Much easier to plant a bomb in a bus. And of course, do you remember Je suis Charlie and We must be solidarity with Brussels? just something just as horrible has happened this week in Syria. ISIS have carried out these attacks, or some other Salafi group, and nothing. No solidarity, no tweet, no hashtag accounts, nothing. Because these are just poor people. Poor people in Syria who are our enemies, and they've been blown up, and we don't care. But of course, when it happens to us, we weep tears, copious tears. At least we pretend to.
Also, this use of foreign insignias has sounded a bit strange by the Americans. But look, the big story, certainly as I could see this week, was this splashing. I mean, obviously, I can't read the Arabic, but you can see it splashed across the Saudi newspapers last weekend. Is this headline that the US blew up the World Trade Center itself as an excuse to start wars around the world? I mean, this is a fairly big thing for the Saudis to be saying, particularly, I suppose, easy for them to say, since their hijackers look to have been the people behind the attack. So, well, aren't they just trying to blame the Americans for something that they got up to?
What's happening is that the politics of 9/11 are finally coming to a head, and what's happened is this: the guy is a senior lawyer in Saudi Arabia who's written the article. And of course, Saudi Arabia being kind of the control society it is, this isn't just random comment. If it's you know, simultaneous in most of the public outlets in Saudi Arabia, you can be pretty sure the regime wants this stuff out there, otherwise it wouldn't be out there. And what's happening is a bit of a face down between the Americans and the Saudis, because the American courts have basically there's Congress are basically going to allow Saudi Arabia to be sued for 9/11. And of course, the Saudi countermove is to say, well, we didn't do it, you did. Now, of course, as the two evil regimes in the US and Saudi Arabia begin to accuse each other of carrying out 9/11, that's when the Iranian and the Russian war machine starts to roll, because they're going to lose World War III, because they're in a shambles.
But Martin, you haven't mentioned this bill going through Congress, have you, about the ability of the US to sue the Saudis?
I just did mention it.
Well, this is really important, because this week, apparently this has all been overturned.
Yeah, I know.
So what on earth is going on there in the United States? Well, this was chugging its way through, and Senator Charles Schumer, another proponent of the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, stuffed an amendment into the final draft, allowing the Attorney General and the Secretary of State to stop any litigation they wanted to. So it's basically a kind of wrecking amendment, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in other words, it suits right-wing politicians in the US to point the finger at Saudi Arabia, but then Saudi Arabia are their allies in trying to destroy Syria, and the Saudis are kicking back and saying, if you start accusing us of carrying out 9/11, we're going to start accusing you. And of course, both sides, both the Americans and the Saudis, have overwhelming evidence that they both cooperated in 9/11, as did the Israelis, and no doubt MI6 had some kind of a role in it. And of course, the Russian general staff has known that for years. General Ivashov, who's in command of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, has made his position pretty clear. The Iranians have made their position pretty clear, although it's not reported in the Western press. Virtually everybody in the world knows that 9/11 was an inside job, apart from the general public in the West.
Well, one person, certainly the London media seem to be completely oblivious to it. But Andreas von Bülow is a German politician, left-wing politician, who was technology minister over there. So I suppose if he's on the internet all the time talking to technology people, he would know about it. But actually in January 2000...
He used to be in the Ministry of Defence as well.
2002, he came out and said, well, I think pretty much exactly what the Saudis were saying. So let's have a listen to Andreas von Bülow now.
Well, you have four options to declare a 9/11. One is it was a strike out of the blue, nobody knew anything. It was the first version the American administration told the public. Then they knew a lot, but in different agencies, and the picture was so difficult to put together that they couldn't find out what was happening, what was in the future. And I think it has broken down, but the administration is fighting on this line. The third option is they let it happen. They knew something, or they knew the whole story and let it happen because they could use it in order to bring about war against up to 60 states, as they said later on. And the fourth version is they organized it or were part of organizing it. And the way it happened is so strange, and the unwillingness of the administration to clear up all the environment is so strong that I finally come to the belief that it must be a steered operation, covert operation. Yeah. I don't know how many people within governments have second thoughts. I think the Secret Services know quite well, and they have the professionals finding out that that this can't happen like the American administration is telling the public. There are experts around which would agree with dissent. But to put it up and to bring it into the operational level for governments, it's very difficult because the American administration is fighting like hell against anybody who is doubting about their version of things. The main aim of the Bush administration is written down in the project of a new American century. They say we have to fight against at least 60 states harboring terrorism, and mostly in the near where oil is situated or gas. And in order to bring the support for this war, this is necessary to have this international new terrorism. It's a clash of civilization. This is the theme which has been brought up in the beginning of the 90s. Sam Huntington told us we have to have new enemies. We have, otherwise Western societies will not be able to lead. So you see this idea behind all this. And I don't believe in Osama bin Laden. I don't believe in Al-Qaeda. I think it's all brought up by continuous faking of intelligence and propaganda.
Propaganda, as he's saying at the end there. But Martin, he's an interesting guy, and this is amazing that he's coming out with this stuff just a few months after the September the 11th attacks. This is, and you're quite right. I just did a little search on him. He was the Secretary of State in the German Federal Ministry of Defence in the late 1970s up until 1980 under Chancellor Helmut Schmidt. And he's pretty much straight on the ball there. And he's also come up with this wonderful and, I think, basic idea, which is that they need enemies, and that's why they have to do things like 9/11.
Yeah, well, that's, you've got to realise, you know, most people say, well, why would they do a thing like that? Well, it's because they need enemies, as he's pointed out. And of course, when he mentioned the security services, no, pretty much went on. What he means is the German security services, who used to oversee and was no doubt, but he used to talk to them quite frequently. They knew very well that the 9/11 was an inside job. In fact, everybody, as I said earlier, the dogs in the street know that 9/11 was an inside job. But try telling that to our friend Mark Weston from the Conservative Party, who's on the first part of the show. It's not in the universe that they live in.
Also, In Search of Enemies. I seem to remember that was a ex-CIA, senior CIA guy. When he retired, started writing all about the stuff he'd been up to, John Stockwell, and he wrote a book called In Search of Enemies, and that was basically, he said that his job was in the CIA, we've got to find a new enemy every week, every year, we're looking for enemies the whole time.
Well, that's right, it's about two things. It's about controlling natural resources to make profits, and it's also about creating enemies so that you can then control the population and, you know, you can get them to do what you want. I mean, in democratic societies, most people don't want to go to war, so you have to make them, to scare the pants off them so that they will.
Nobody wants a war. Nobody wants a crash.
But some people do want a war, because war is what they do. I'm just reading several interesting books at the moment about what keeps wars going and why war is actually functional. I mean, I think it was a famous anarchist slogan, war is the health of the state.
What is that supposed to mean? Well, it's not, is it?
No. States thrive on war. States are built by war. States make war. That's what states are for. They're not for looking after the homeless.
They're not for paying for the National Health Service?
Well, they are as well, but that's an afterthought. And in many countries, of course, not even an afterthought.
What about what Andreas von Bülow was saying there? I found quite fascinating. He said four options over 9/11. One, that it's an attack out of the blue. Two, that they just didn't have the right intelligence in the right place. It was difficult to kind of put together a picture of the attack before it happened. Three, that they knew it was going to happen in the intelligence services in the US, and they let it happen because they thought they could use it as a kind of consequences from it to their own benefit. And lastly, which is the one he says, he actually says that he believes that the US intelligence services, parts of the US government, actually took part in organising it.
Well, for those who are interested in this kind of topic, there are two strands there that you mentioned. One is LIHOP, the other is MIHOP. Let it happen on purpose and made it happen on purpose. And whenever you hear, bombs going off in Syria or Northern Ireland or buildings like the World Trade Center being taken down, there's usually more of a story behind what's happening than you would think. That's the way the world actually works. And I think it's pretty, the evidence, don't forget, three buildings came down on 9/11. The two killer facts for me is the third building, WTC-7, collapses with no plane hitting it. So how could that, I mean, the story is that the plane fires brought the buildings down. Nonsense. But the third building went down without a plane hitting it. The other point is, where was the United States Air Force on this glorious day? In the Battle of Britain, it took, 10-15 minutes to get airborne. These planes are flying around inside the most heavily defended airspace in the world for over an hour and a half, and none of them are intercepted by the most expensive air force ever assembled. Doesn't add up, does it? And in actual fact, we know what was happening. They'd all been sent on an exercise in Canada, so there was nobody around. Deliberately so. General Ivashov, as I mentioned earlier, was the commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, and he has been very quietly saying for years, you may have fooled everybody else, the people who did this, but you haven't fooled us, and we're the Russian military.
Von Bülow has spoken out this week in German press about the Dresden Bilderberg conference that we should be covering, hopefully, on this show in a couple of weeks' time. He says that the Bilderberg conference is the hidden objective, really, is to target the present-day Western European leaders and get them to commit to the projects of the United States in the Ukraine, particularly the fight against Russia. In contrast, he says, in Europe, especially in Germany and France, there's still a lot of resistance against committing NATO Western European troops to the fight in Ukraine.
Well, that's right. We're talking about the creation of enemies here, and Al-Qaeda has been a useful kind of fiction for years to keep the tills ticking over. But the real money will come through an arms race with Russia. That's where Lockheed Martin and BAE Systems are going to really cash in, and their shareholders, of course, many of whom are former politicians. It's pretty silly, because I think all military analysis that I've read suggests that NATO, if it tries to further aggress Russia, would lose a military confrontation. The Russians are being very calm. Don't forget, we're putting missile systems into Romania and Poland, which are still supposedly there to protect Western Europe from the Iranian nuclear threat, which no longer exists, even according to the US government.
Well, one of the things,
but of course, the Russians are just saying, well, that's stupid. What you're doing is you're putting missiles in our face. And of course, our obvious response would be to put a similar missile system in Cuba. What would you think about that? Oh, you'd think it was World War III, wouldn't you? Well, if you put those missile systems in our face, we might respond appropriately.
Well, one of the things von Bülow's saying is that he's been to a Bilderberg conference many years ago, but he's a little bit like Will Hutton. He's not really enamoured with it. He says, effectively, there's one purpose for these meetings. That is to bring in all the most powerful politicians in Europe and other people like newspaper editors, and to see if any of them dare to speak out against what the US policy is in Syria and Ukraine, identify them, and then after the meeting, remove them.
Well, either remove them or, it's join us or die.
They want to know who opinion formers and powerful people in the Western world is going to oppose. And that's actually essentially, it's a kind of, the Bilderberg conference is a kind of trap that these people, the idea is to walk in there. And if you start speaking out against what the Americans are going to do, they're going to find ways to get rid of you in the next few months.
Well, exactly. And of course, Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, pointed the finger at Bilderberg as the ultimate source of terrorism in Italy in the 70s and 80s, which it probably is. Bilderberg is a very important meeting as part of the Western military-industrial complex, but I'm quite sure that the real decisions aren't taken at Bilderberg. It's where they assemble the officers to be told what they're going to be doing. It doesn't decide things. It's a lower down the food chain than that.
Having the meeting just a couple of weeks before the EU referendum here in Britain, I mean, the Bilderberg conferences over the years have been very instrumental, certainly according to McGee. I think he was the John McGee, the US ambassador to West Germany back in the 1980s, said that the European Union was formed at the Bilderberg meetings. I mean, he'd seen it all in his face. I imagine this was around about the same era von Bülow was invited. But I suppose that there must be some kind of tension, really, in that it looks like the various failures in the European project, whether or not you're going to vote in or out, are going to be coming up at the Bilderberg conference. They're going to be saying, well, hang on a minute, how can we make it a more interesting and inviting the EU, a more interesting and inviting organisation to be part of, because they've had the euro crisis, the financial disaster, and the migrant crisis, as well as several other crises over the last few years. They basically proved that they cannot run a booze up in a brewery.
Well, they will be discussing Brexit, no doubt, but they'll also be discussing Syria, they'll also be discussing Ukraine, they'll also be discussing the global economy, which is about to blow up in everybody's faces. These people are the masterminds, or rather, they're not the masterminds. They're, as I say, it's not a decision-making body. It's where they gather the opinion formers to tell them what to do and what to think. But if you carry out a little thought experiment, if 9/11 was an inside job, and I believe it was, just like the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980 by NATO intelligence services, just like the coup in the Ukraine where the snipers shot down both protesters and police, and have pretty clear evidence suggests that they were from Pravi sector and that they'd been trained by British special forces and supplied with British weaponry. This is the real world, as anybody in West Belfast will tell you. But don't try running that out in Middle England, because they live in a bubble where none of this is really happening.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the hour a dialect show next Tuesday, and as part of that program, earlier this week, I interviewed US Marine Corps veteran Mike Sparks in the United States. He's got a website called Combat Reform. He describes himself as a combat reformer, someone who's been into the military, seen the problems with it, actually been faced with, senior US military staff, and he has a real kind of critical view of the way they tend to do things. And so I thought it'd be interesting to see what his view was going forward of the possibility of a President Trump and what that might mean for the conflicts in Ukraine and Syria, for example.
It depends. Let's say President Trump becomes the reality, right? It will depend on the amount of advice and the quality of advice he's fed. If Trump is fed this line of bull that the Ukraine is, you know, some wonderful country the United States and Europe should threaten its very survival on defending, then we will have a mini war in the Ukraine, because you have the Malenkov hurting for profits. They need a boogeyman. And if they think that it can be kept down to a non-nuclear level, which happened before, I'm not saying it's sound, I totally disagree with this. The Red Chinese fought us in the Korean War. And you say, well, they didn't have the nuclear weapons then. Right, but it's the idea of it, superpowers can somehow, you know, fight with one arm tied behind their back. That would be a fear. That would be a worry that we would fight through the Ukrainians and then the Russians would fight through the Russian separatists and we'd have a de facto World War III that way. In the case of Syria, what's happening in Syria is the Central Intelligence Agency has created a hornet's nest by choice to attract nihilist Islamists there. Nihilism is the belief there's nothing worth living for. I'm going to die, have 20 virgins, whatever. You know, if that's the case, why don't you off yourself and go meet the virgins? Why don't you leave us alone? But here in present day. Anyway, it's a scam to get these people who are nihilists to go to Syria and have their day as a rock star. And you play whack-a-mole with them, meaning, oh, there's a mole, whack it, precision-guided munition. There goes $1 million. Whack him. There he is. $4 billion just last year of whack-a-mole ISIS. Now, ISIS should also tell you that that's a CIA concoction, because ISIS is this nice breasty chick from Egypt. John Gardner, a James Bond author, talked of ISIS in one of his novels years before, and he's living in Northern Virginia. So there's no doubt that continuation James Bond author Gardner was in the loop. And there he's got an ISIS reference.
So, yes, that's Mike Sparks from combatreform.com. Martin, he's talking about a $4 billion whack-a-mole Ka-ching.
Well, that's right. So we arm and train jihadi terrorists. We infiltrate them into Syria with British SAS support. They blow things up and kill loads of people. And then we say, oh, look at these terrible terrorists. We'll have to intervene in Syria to try and stop them. And the evidence is piling up that we, for example, NATO, carried out the Ghouta chemical weapons attack in order to try and create an excuse for intervention, etc., etc., etc. Now, of course, the problem for the warmongers in the West is that the Russians, the Chinese and the Iranians are very well aware of what's going on, and they've lost all faith in the kind of things that we're saying, and they're not relying on our goodwill. They're relying on their own strength. And ultimately, of course, the evil of 9/11 will lead to what it was going to lead to, which is a huge confrontation.
Well, not necessarily if it all comes out, because it looks as if it's only the Washington... No, listen, Martin, only the Washington Press and the London Press seem to be the only people still spinning this line about 9/11. Most of the rest of the world...
It's the Achilles heel in the whole game. The most senior US military figure to speak out about 9/11 has been General Albert Stubblebine, Major General Albert Stubblebine. And ultimately, of course, you may have a situation where loyal patriotic officers in the US are forced to take on their colleagues who are the terrorists. Same thing may have to happen inside the British Army. That's what World War III will look like.
Now, we also had a report towards the end of last year. We were looking at this article, 9/11 Israel Did It, All the Proof in the World. Mm-hmm. Controversial article. And actually, I don't think it necessarily does prove that Israel did it, but it certainly does imply that there was a Secret Service collaboration, military-industrial complex collaboration between the Israelis and the Americans. I mean, surely something like this would have come out long, long ago if it were true.
It has come out. I mean, another military figure in the US who's spoken out about this is...
Not Alan Sabrowski. You're talking about Sabrowski.
Yeah. He's a Jewish officer, and he's quite clear Israel were the main force behind 9/11. But, of course, they wouldn't have been able to do it on their own. They're doing it working with their allies in CIA and MI6. That's the reality. And people can go, oh, that's just silly, we don't believe in any of that. Well, I'll tell you what. I tell you who does believe in it: the Russian general staff, the Iranian general staff, the people you are going to have to fight. And one of the ways they're going to fight you is they're going to drop into the international news cycle telephone conversations which prove, for example, that you did it. They are going to blackmail the pants off the Western military establishment. And, of course, they haven't done it so far. They've held back. But if you keep pushing them, the Russians will leak everything they've got. And it will prove to all, even the most sceptical people, that they did indeed do it. The Russians don't want to do that. They'd rather do a deal. But if it comes down to it and Russian soldiers are being shot by British soldiers, they'll say, right, we're going to pull the rug from under you. Bang. And then World War III will start and hopefully end quickly with a defeat for the warmongers in the West.
Well, interesting you should talk about that, because President Obama has been in Hiroshima today, the first American president to visit the site since the end of the Second World War, and the 140,000 people that died in almost the blink of an eye with the explosion of the world's first aggressively used atomic weapon. Now, there are questions also about whether the US at the time even really needed to do that.
Well, one of the reasons they needed to do that is that the Russian army was storming through China towards Japan. And they might even have taken Japan while the Americans pussyfooted around, shall we invade, or we might have some heavy casualties. The Russians were coming down and saying, well, we'll do it. We can take heavy casualties. We'll take Japan.
But it is a historic moment, isn't it? It's quite, isn't it? Do you think a good thing? I mean, I know you seem to moan about Obama quite a lot, but he seems to be doing as much as he can before he leaves office to sort of, to mend some of these old wounds.
Well, I mean, yes, and also Cameron's been over there, the G7 or whatever, and they've all gone to the Yasukuni Shrine, which is a shrine to Japan's glorious war dead. And this is part, and the Chinese don't find that particularly amusing. We are going to go and read. I mean, those who fail to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat it. And I'm afraid we haven't learned the lessons of history. We're playing the same silly games we played before World War I with 21st century weapons. And psychological manipulation, psychological warfare has become dominant since the Second World War. And the West has tried to manipulate public opinion through violence and through the manipulation of the media. And ultimately, they've created a hellish situation for the majority of the world's population, including many people in our own country. and ultimately something will have to be done about it. These challenges have to be accepted.
I mentioned that article, 9/11, Israel did it, all the proof in the world. Well, I mean, one of the interesting sections of that looks at many powerful people in the US who actually had joint US-Israeli citizenship. It also talks about prior knowledge, Gomel chest cemetery incident, the Israeli citizens getting tipped off just before the September the 11th attacks, anomalous trading in security markets, also the Israeli espionage around the 9/11 attacks. After 9/11, more detentions of Israelis, and the five dancing Israelis.
Well, the five dancing Israelis, I think, is the most interesting from the point of view of our listeners, because when the second, the first plane hit the World Trade Center, they were standing on top of a white van with a video camera filming it, and when it hit the World Trade Center, they all did high fives. Now, somebody was looking out of their window, saw them doing that, wrote down the number of the van, and gave it to the local police in New York. 8 hours later, that van was stopped, and those people turned out to be Mossad agents. And what they ultimately got back to Israel, and they were interviewed on Israeli TV, and they said, yes, we were Mossad agents, there was nothing to worry about, we were just documenting the attack. Documenting a surprise attack that nobody knew was coming, but they knew it was coming because they were ready to take a photograph.
And then the article goes on to talk about the cover-up. It says 9/11 investigation was in Zionist hands. All appointed chief judges were also Zionists, and the 9/11 commission was Zionist-controlled. I mean, it does seem like it may be just a kind of hate campaign against the Zionists.
No, I think I think Sabrowski, who is a Jewish American officer, is pretty clear. Israel was the main beneficiary of 9/11, as Netanyahu on the day said, well, this will be good for Israel because it'll remind the West of what we
put
up with
all the
time.
This is a whole section in that article saying that Netanyahu was openly gleeful about the 9/11 attacks.
Well, he would be if his security forces had carried them out on his orders. There's a lot of people, there's a big queue at Nuremberg and a big queue at The Hague, isn't there?
I suppose, ultimately, though, Martin, is the truth... I mean, you mentioned that the Russians might bring the truth. Do you think it's going to take more than just the Saudis talking
about
this? Well,
the fact that the Saudis have decided to raise the stakes like this shows... You see, what should have happened after 9/11 is they should have achieved their various objectives, conquered various places, achieved what they wanted. And they've been pretty good at starting wars. They've started a lot of wars. They've just not been able to finish them and win them, because the West is dominated by arms dealers, whereas the Russian military is dominated by soldiers. There's a big difference.
Well, I suppose one of the backlashes from this domestically is more and more of an attempt to sort of move towards a police state and to control people. And I was rather concerned to see that over the last couple of weeks in the US, there's been reports coming out, really becoming very propagandistic, only showing one side of it, talking about microchipping children. And let's have a listen to one of those, which went out on a TV station in Tampa, Florida, just a few days ago.
It happens in seconds. Moms and dads, you know that feeling. Your child gets lost in a store, maybe just wanders off for a second or two. Your heart stops, though. Panic sets in, and you think the worst. It's happened to most of us, but what if you had a secret weapon, an extra layer of safety, so to speak? How far would you go to keep your children secure?
Would you be willing to microchip them? Experts tell us the technology already exists. Turns out one Bay Area mother is all for it, and she shared her story with our Melanie Michael.
Chances are, if you have a four-legged family member at home, it's already microchipped. And if the technology exists to save Fido in an emergency, what about microchipping your child?
I want my son back!
We've seen it in movies.
This is my daughter!
Over and over again, children gone missing. Stephanie's teenage daughter is a special needs child, prone to wander off and trust strangers. For that very reason, Stephanie wholeheartedly welcomes microchipping a child.
If a small chip the size of a grain of rice could have prevented a tragedy, I think most parents, hindsight would have said, I wish I would have done it.
A well-known technology expert out of Boston tells us microchipping poses little to no health risks and would act as a barcode of sorts.
Without question, It could save a life.
And it's the size of a grain of rice, very, very small. And the expert that we spoke with actually tells us that barcodes were introduced in the late 1960s, and back then people thought, this is way too invasive and too weird, and now barcodes are so commonplace that we don't even think about them anymore. The expert tells us this will happen sooner rather than later.
But, I mean, have companies actually tried this? That's a different scenario.
It did not go through, but you can bet somewhere, someday, someone is going to pull this off, and we could see those microchips in everyone.
That's interesting to think about. Melanie Michael, live in Tampa.
Yes, Tampa, Florida. Martin, the only thing they don't talk about there is that there's a massive blue chip company, if you can call it blue chip, I don't know, that's created these microchips. So actually what they're doing there is a kind of advertising under the guise of news. They're not any, there's no critical side to the way they're reporting it. And some companies stand to make billions out of microchipping humans.
We're dealing with a situation where a totalitarian state is being constructed around us brick by brick, chip by chip. I think the real problem, of course, in Syria, of course, is not people being microchipped, it's having their kids blown to bits by terrorists supplied and armed by our own armed forces.
But what about a sort of more activated? I mean, like in France this week, for example, there's been a very, very active resistance to what the government's doing in France. That sort of thing could spread to other parts of the West, couldn't it?
Well, it could indeed. But the real danger, of course, is that out of that chaos comes the growth of extreme right movements, which, of course, have been very much part of the plan from the point of view of the totalitarians who are behind the situation. We are definitely in danger of a world war and probably a totalitarian state. Those things are staring us in the face as we worry about rearranging the deck chairs on the Brexit Titanic.
One thing I would say about the microchips is that it's pretty clear that those chips would be like a kind of, you know, the chip and pin in your card. It would be very, very simple to put that into a microchip if it was in your hand or wherever, whichever part of your body it was. So you could use that for transactions, and they may sell it that way. Say, for example, if there's a lot of hacking goes on, yeah, of people's bank accounts, oh, you've got to have the thing in your hand, and then you can buy and sell.
Yeah, well,
no,
but the point is,
nobody can hack
you. Then get a situation where people can't use cash to buy things. You can get rid of cash, and that means you can then manipulate the financial system.
What's the problem with getting rid of cash? I mean, that's happening in other parts of Europe anyway.
Yeah, but the point about it is that then, for example, if you went to the bank like Northern Rock on the day that you want, you know, that it crashed and everybody queued about to get their money out, they just say, no, you can't. You can't take it out, and we can stop you taking it out. Your money is our money. And that's where we're going.
I mean, you could also be in a situation where you may have £10,000 in the bank, but the bank just switches off your chip, and that's it. You haven't got nothing.
That's right. And these kind of things are likely to happen. And the chaos that's going to come will lead to what will be called in the history books World War III. It's already started. The point is, having already started, it's the democratic forces that must finish it as we finish the last two world wars, and that means a defeat for the Western militarists.
Well, it's worth mentioning that rest his soul, Ron Stone, when he was in here, he was a big dog fancier. He used to take dogs to Crufts. And we asked him about this. He was dead against it. He said he wouldn't even get his dogs microchipped. He thought it was a terrible idea.
Well, look, I've got limited interest in this because we know the technologies of mass surveillance are growing all the time. The real problem is the people in charge of this mass surveillance are criminals and terrorists.
That's right. I mean, this is the problem, isn't it, that we've got this Snoopers Charter going through at the moment, which is effectively just trying to bring into line, into legality, what criminal activities of the intelligence services for years now.
We are, as I repeat again what I said earlier, a totalitarian police state is being built brick by brick while we watch on passively. It's time for us to start behaving less like sheep and more like wolves.
And maybe more like the French.
Indeed.
The winning of the Palme d'Or this week by Ken Loach got very little reporting. I was really shocked to see that Britain is going to win the greatest artistic, well, you could argue the Palme d'Or is the greatest artistic award in the world, then there would be a little bit more coverage of it, but it was all about austerity. So let's have a listen now to a little clip from Ken Loach's new film, which is all about austerity, and it's called I, Daniel Blake.
There isn't anything else anybody can do today. So what I'm going to have to do is look. I have to follow the rules. And the thing is, if you're going to be aggressive with me, then I'm going to have to ask.
It's not about me being aggressive.
No, I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
I'm trying to explain to you a situation, and you don't care.
Security.
I don't know why people like you do.
Security. Taking you to the decision maker.
It's all the same thing. I don't want to read your language because it's all the same thing.
I'm sorry, Lord, but you're going to have to.
I don't. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Take your hands off me. I'm going to speak to the manager. I don't want to speak to you.
I'm just trying.
Sorry.
Yeah. I'm just explaining
it's
what's
you
happening
here.
No,
right, come and talk to me then if you've got something to say.
All right. I've tried to explain to the woman. I've never been to Newcastle before. We've just moved up here from London. I've been here a few days. I don't know where I'm going, okay? I was on the bus. It's gone the wrong way. We've run, got off the bus, run, so there wasn't any more late. She just doesn't want to know. She doesn't want to know. And now she's telling me she's going to refer me for a sanction.
What I want you to do is listen to me, okay? The lady's told you what's right. There's rules here, rules that we have to stick to, okay? It isn't against you. Well, you have
mate,
a duty.
Listen, I'm not saying it's against
you
me.
You have
all
a duty
is,
to be here on time.
And I'm explaining to you why I wasn't here on time.
Do you know
but
what?
I got lost.
I understand, right? But what I gather now is the decision maker. The decision maker's going to be sending you a letter through the post. You're going to have to wait for that. And then you're going
to... My kids have got to start school tomorrow. I've got about 12 quid in my purse.
Do you know what?
Because you can't just calm down and listen to people when they talk.
Right.
You all
Again,
have to do this.
Do you know what? I've listened to you. You've created a scene. I think
I've created a scene. If I was going to create a scene, you'd know about it.
You need to leave the building.
I'm sorry,
okay,
you need to.
This is ridiculous.
Jesus Christ.
What am I supposed to do?
Who's first in this queue?
I am.
Do you mind if this young lass signs on first?
No, you carry on.
There you go. Now you can go back to your desk and let her sign on and do the job that the taxpayer pays you for. This is a disgrace.
Listen, all right? This doesn't have to involve you. Everybody's trying to do their job here and you're creating more of a scene again.
Well, it sounds like a very powerful piece of work. And, of course, we've seen a lot of Ken Loach in Bristol because he only lives over in Bath and he comes over here quite frequantly to give talks and in support of various struggles that people in Bristol
well,
are engaged in.
He hopes that this film will have the effect that Cathy Come Home had back in the 1960s, but yet it's received almost zero coverage, even though it's won the Palme d'Or. Unbelievable.
Well, Cathy Come Home, of course, was you know, everybody used to watch BBC because there wasn't much else to watch back then those days and had a major impact because everybody watched it. I'm afraid this film, which will be shown in, you know, probably be shown in the Watershed in Bristol, will be watched by those who are already, you know, pretty much convinced of the film's message. But I think it is great that Ken Loach is still going, and of course he is his work is very varied, actually. It's not just one strand. He's got various strings to his bow, and you know, you can see that he is very much appreciated by film buffs in the rest of the world, but not so much by our own Tory government, I don't suppose.
What does it say about the whole austerity food bank sanctioned Britain?
Well, I need to see the film to make that
judgment.
Well,
you've heard a little bit there. I mean, I think it's amazing, isn't it, that you've got this kind of insight into what goes on inside these job centres.
I mean, one of the things he was asked when he was interviewed is what effect he thinks it might have. And I think part of the problem is that people are bombarded every day when they pick up the Tory press or put on Channel 4's Benefit Street with what is essentially extremely nasty propaganda about poor people and how terrible they are and how useless they are and how they deserve their own misfortune. And, you know, I'm afraid there is a streak in the British of... And Dickens picked up on this, of course, in a lot of his novels, of real nastiness towards people at the bottom of the pile. And, of course, Loach, in the great British tradition of Dickens, is pointing his finger at the hypocrites, not at the poor.
We're going to have a listen now to a professor from California State University, Professor Michael Perelman, talking about something that sounds very boring called primitive accumulation. But effectively, he's talking about the beginning days, the early days of capitalism. Could you just set out the stall, Martin, about the role of people like Adam Smith and Thomas More when the first kind of beginnings of the Industrial Revolution began to happen here in Britain?
Well, Thomas More was quite a long time before the Industrial Revolution, but I mean, primitive accumulation is effectively a Marxist term. Marx invented it. And what he's talking about is eventually capitalism settles down and people build a better widget and try and sell it for cheaper and so on. But in the first place, you get wealth and power by stealing it. which is, you saw primitive accumulation going on in the former Soviet Union in the early 1990s, where, you know, basically the assets of the society were being carved up at gunpoint.
And what about gangsters? What about this idea that an essential part of this capitalism is depriving people of their rights? That is to say, taking things away that they need to live on.
Well, if you want people to work in your factory, you've got to make damn sure they've got no alternative. So if you take away their access to land, which is what was done in Britain, and of course still goes on in places like Brazil, those people...
Or housing.
Then they have to work for you for fear of falling into the underclass, which will then be, chucked off their benefits,
I remember Tony Benn saying that when he walked down the street and saw homeless people, he thought that one of the main purposes for having street homeless out there is to remind everybody to keep in line.
Absolutely. It's social discipline. But of course it's not... a lot of what is going on around the world now is pretty much primitive accumulation. You know, instead of trying to trade with people on an equal basis, we want to steal their stuff. We don't want to steal their stuff, but Western corporations, banks, and the military that support them want to steal their stuff.
It does seem as if we've done this kind of thing in places like Libya. It has been absolutely denied to the people that live there, even.
Well, we've been doing this for a long time. Imperialism, the desire to try and dominate and steal from others, is very much part of human history and very much part of British history.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now to Professor Michael Perelman from California State University.
Smith's speculation about the economic bing-bang of primitive accumulation evoked no further comment until 1821, when Robert Torrens picked up the story. And Torrens' quote reads, "In the first stone which the savage flings at the wild animal, he pursues in the first stick that he seizes to strike down the fruit which hangs above his reach. We see the appropriation of one article for the purpose of aiding in the acquisition of another." So Marx responds to Torrens quite humorously. He says, "No doubt this first stick," which of course is Stock in German, "would explain why stock is synonymous with capital. Knowing full well that the low-hanging fruit of early capitalism was a violent seizure of other people's means of production. Of course, throughout history, people have taken land from others. The forcible removal of people's means of production for the purpose of commercial gain only came later, after the growing urban population of Northwest Europe increased the demand for wool. At the time, the agricultural surplus was very small. In 1520, 100 families on the land could only grow enough to support 106 families, hardly a surplus at all. By throwing people off the land, a relatively few remaining people could take care of a large flock of sheep. Because the cost of their upkeep was relatively small, huge profits could occur. Now, the first protest against this came from Sir Thomas More's Utopia, where he talks about sheep now devour men. But it wasn't sheep devouring men, it was our early proto-capitalists. In contrast, Smith was intent on defending capitalism, lest it be tarred with any disreputable behavior. He set out to make the case that primitive accumulation had nothing at all to do with capitalism. The core of his ideological project was to present capitalism as a natural system of voluntary market relations, devoid of conflict, and beneficial to all mankind.
Well, I wonder what you make of that, Martin. It seems as if there is really effectively saying that for capitalism to function, we have to actually destroy any idea of people having human rights, because we've got to take those human rights away before that they will get involved in a production line sort of factory process, and that there isn't any real expectation of an equal deal between employer and employee.
No, but of course the ideology as espoused by... I mean, Adam Smith's actually quite a useful author. I mean, and Marx openly acknowledged his debt to Smith. He saw Smith as the most sensible capitalist argument, and he based a lot of his own theories on Smith and Ricardo's work.
Perelman says that Smith misses out all the really important parts of capitalism.
Yeah, well, then that's what Marx brought that back in. But of course, Marx was also prepared to see capitalism as potentially progressive force because it did change social relations. But we're still living out these trajectories started a long time ago. There's a big debate in Marxist economics called the Brenner debate, which is about how feudalism becomes capitalism. But I don't suppose we've got time to go into it right now.
Final story, Martin. Yalon quits the defence minister post in Israel, warning of an extremist rise under Netanyahu. Israel's defence minister resigned last week, saying the nation was being taken over by extremist and dangerous elements after the Prime Minister Netanyahu moved to replace him with a far-right politician in an effort to strengthen his coalition.
Well, they've been supporting the jihadi terrorists in Syria as well, and as we were hearing earlier, it's possibly Mossad who are main players on 9/11. Should the state of Israel still be sitting in the United Nations?
And just the latest news, just in the last few hours, a poll in Israel is saying that a party led by Yalon and others could beat the Likud party in Israel.
Well, that would be a good and a positive development if it did happen. And I've noticed that some Israeli generals are speaking out against what these policies are. So there may be some good elements even in the Israeli Defence Force. We're going to need all of those good elements if we're going to survive the coming cataclysm.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Up next, it's Makawi and Kamal's Arabian Nights. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Tory group or Bristol City Council's leader, Mark Weston. I'm on Twitter, at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable bank holiday. Do please join us on The Politics Show at 5 o'clock next week. And don't let the banksters get you down.
93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.